Vision. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Elizabeth Press.
And I'm Eric Newton. Today we have Rensselaer County historian Kathy Sheehan here to discuss with us the Historical Society's campaign to purchase a priceless portrait from Troy's past. Then we'll hear an interview with Rutgers University students Mariah Pierce and Anthony Tullio. They travel with their Rutgers mentor, Adam Statz, and artist, Jana McCone, to study biographic zine making with photographer Brenda Ann Keneally at the Sanctuary for Independent Media.
Afterwards, we'll hear from Denise Figueroa of the Independent Living Center in Troy about disability rights activism.
And later on, we'll hear from some local theater students at the Sage Colleges who are putting together a cabaret-style show. Let's start the show off with some local headlines.
According to the New York Times, a new class action lawsuit alleges that the New York Police Department's policy of removing religious head coverings during arrest photographs is a violation of detainees' civil rights. In addition to seeking damages for those affected by the photograph policy, the lawsuit petitions for a court order to halt the policy. A representative from the Council on American-Islamic Relations stated that being forced to remove headgear violates, quote, their sense of dignity and their sincerely held religious beliefs. New York City's law department claims that the policy of removing religious head coverings is a necessary part of police procedure.
After nearly 50 years in prison, former Black Liberation Army member Herman Bell has been released on parole. He was originally convicted in the killing of two police officers. During his prison sentence, Bell has gained graduate degrees and started programs to help other inmates. In 2017, the 70-year-old inmate was beaten by several prison guards and sustained serious injuries. Crucial to the parole board's decision was a letter from one of the deceased officer's sons saying, "The simple answer is it would bring joy and peace as we have already forgiven Herman Bell publicly. On the other hand, to deny him parole again would cause us great pain, as we are reminded of the painful episode each time he appears before the board." Prison justice advocates have called his parole a victory, while police and major media outlets have expressed dismay.
Katie Cusack of The Alt reports that the state budget proposal has been amended to allow for renewable energy in the Sheraton Hollow neighborhood of Albany. The original proposal only allowed for oil and gas energy. Environmental, economic, and racial justice advocates are concerned about the severely neglected Sheraton Hollow neighborhood, which has a long history of pollution and illness related to dirty energy production.
On Friday, March 23rd, the Troy Boys and Girls Club is hosting a Mental Health Matters event at 6 p.m. as an opportunity to learn more about mental health and to continue to break down its stigma.
And a public service announcement. The next Troy Finance Committee meeting will be on Thursday, March 22nd at 6 p.m. The next Troy Zoning Board of Appeals meeting will be on Tuesday, April 3rd at 6 p.m. And the next general meeting of the Troy City Council will be on Thursday, April 5th at 7 p.m. All of these meetings are open to the public and take place at Troy City Hall in Headley Building at 433 River Street.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or heartwarming praises, you can text us at 518-888-3004. And now on to our first segment. Kathy Sheehan, Rensselaer County's official historian, joins us now to tell us about an 1840s portrait of Peter F. Baltimore the Rensselaer County Historical Society is trying to acquire. Kathy, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So, where should we get started? This portrait of Peter F. Baltimore. Who was Peter F. Baltimore, And why does he matter to the Historical Society?
Well, I hope he matters to nationally. I hope he matters to everyone, because the one really good thing about living in this area is that we get to tell so much of the history of the national stories, some of the things that we may have read in our geography books and social studies books as kids, but it's the microcosmic story that tells the national story. And the Peter Baltimore story is a story of abolition. And Peter Baltimore was a free black man born in the late 1820s. And his father, Samuel Baltimore, we're still trying to research, was he an escaped slave? Was he also a free black man? And he was here in Troy around 1803 and establishes an oyster parlor and did all sorts of things, trying to establish schools for the freedom seekers after that happened, as well as the free black community that was established here in Troy. For maybe people that don't remember, is New York State was also a slaveholding state until 1827. So this area became such a center for the abolitionist movement. And Peter started becoming a barber. He went through he was in educated, and then worked with his older brother, and was a barber on First Street, right near what was the Troy House. And when we think about the freedom seekers, the first image that you see, a lot of images that you see are the people with little backpacks, kind of hiding in hay bales and things like that. Well, in this area, they were coming right up the Hudson River. And they were getting off at these packet boats and canal boats. And Peter Baltimore's barbershop was just a block away. So they would be sent over to Peter. And some of those people would need clothing and food and shelter.
And haircuts.
Well, yes, that too. And working their way up through the eventually working their way to Canada, where they were free. However, this area was so abolitionist friendly, many people stayed here. So Peter would get them jobs as maybe porters at the Troy House next door, maybe whitewashers, domestic help, coachmen. Some of them went to work on the docks, and they stayed. Right next door to his barbershop was the Athenaeum building. There's a parking lot there now. For those familiar with Troy, it's the area right across the street from Slide and Dirty on First Street. And in the Athenaeum were the offices of the Mental and Moral Improvement Society, which was run by a black man by the name of William Rich, who was his friend. There was also the home of the Troy Female African Benevolent Society. So all these organizations took place. And white people and persons of color were all helping with this. One of Peter's good friends was a white abolitionist lawyer named Martin Ingram Townsend, and he was just amazing trial lawyer and a great abolitionist movement person. And the other person that also helped was Pliny Moore. Pliny Moore was a white man who had a he had a big grain elevator on the Hudson River. So those canal boats and packet boats that were harboring the slaves, he was helping them. So he'd get them over to Peter. So he's a really important person. Then you take that story and the fact that it's very rare, first off, in the late 1840s or 1850s, which is about the period of this watercolor, to have watercolors that survive, to have a watercolor that survives of a black man who is extremely well-dressed and really it's an amazing picture. He's holding a pen. He's got paper, so he's literate. I mean, there's all these kind of clues that you do when you have portraits done. So to have this, it's so rare. And he's such an important part of the history of Troy and by extension, our national history of the abolitionist movement.
One thing that's really striking about that portrait is his smile. Mm-hmm. He has a very warm and congenial expression on his face, and it's not usually what we expect for 19th century portraiture, usually very stern. Was it very uncommon to have a portrait done that way?
No, I don't think so. I think when you look at some portraits, you do see people that are more smiling. And we don't know who the artist is. It's not identified. We don't even know where it took place. It's possible it was done in Troy. There were certainly many artists that were here. It also could have been done in New York City. One of the things when Peter was a young man, he was befriended by the Reverend Henry Highland Garnett, who was the first black minister of the Liberty Street Presbyterian Church for Colored People. That was the actual name of the church. And he took him to New York City, and they went to abolitionist rallies. That's where he met Frederick Douglass, who then turns around and comes to Troy and speaks
right,
in an abolitionist rally.
After him, right?
He also, yes, when Peter Baltimore's son, Garnett Baltimore, was born, they named their son Garnett Douglas Baltimore, Garnett after Henry Highland Garnett, and the Douglas after Frederick Douglass, of course. So that watercolor may have been done in New York City, but yes, it does. He has a little bit of a smile, not a huge one that we think of today, but certainly a little bit more. And it's really a beautiful. A beautiful portrait, and I was lucky to see it in person. We went to where it's on the Antiques Center, where it's on consignment, mm-hmm. and so I got to look at it. And he actually, it's a very navy blue coat, the style and the tie. It's really a wonderful piece, and I can't wait for us to have it here so everybody can see it.
How did you first learn about this portrait that was for sale, and how did you first learn about Peter Baltimore himself?
We knew about the watercolor from right after 9/11, and we knew it went up for auction, and it just timing was not right, and we kind of missed it, and then it went into private hands. And but then in the end of January, the owners of the gallery called our curator, Stacy Draper, and said, this is up for sale. And what was interesting about this gallery is when they see something, they realize it's that important. They like to contact museums first to see if there's a way that you can get it before it goes to private hands again. Because if it did, it could be, you know, it could be sitting in someone's house and not everyone's ever going to get that. So we just are so grateful that they said, you know, we would like to let's give it. You get the first shot at it, and it's been an incredible community support that has come out to get this. Yeah,
it's $15,000,
which is a really good price, believe it or not.
Yeah.
I know it seems like, oh my gosh, and it is. It's a huge amount of money. It is. I know Stacy said it's probably, and she's been there for 40 years. I've been there for 30. The two of us probably think it's probably the singular most important piece that we've received in our collection all these years.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how can people contribute to help make sure that it makes its way home?
That it makes it. I know we're at a little over $11,000 right now. So we have about just about a month left to raise the rest of to get to 15. They can go to our website, which is www.rchsonline.org. And you can go to our Facebook page, Rensselaer County Historical Society, and there'll be a link. It says Bring Peter Home. And you can stop down and see us. We are located at 57 2nd Street in Troy. We're right between Congress and State Street. So kind of right between the music hall and the courthouse on the left-hand side. And you can bring a donation there.
For our listeners who might not really know the significance of the Historical Society and the role you play in this region, maybe you could just say one more sentence about your work.
Oh, thanks. We've been around as an organization since 1927. We collect the history of Rensselaer County. And that includes three-dimensional objects, as well as we have a huge research library, which I'm very thrilled to say we've done lots of projects with the Sanctuary for Independent Media and particularly the summer program with the kids. We do a lot of going into schools and lectures, and people come in to do research. So we have everything from, you know, furniture and artifacts to amazing, you know, historic ledgers and business papers and church records and, oh my gosh, we have over 10,000 images alone, photographic images alone in our collection. So
wow. It is pretty impressive. I must say I've seen it myself. Would acquiring this portrait of Baltimore, would it require special storage and handling in order just to keep it around?
Yeah, it does. Watercolors are very, very fragile, as you can imagine. It's not like, you know, oil paint on canvas. Watercolor is a paper by the very nature of the paper and the pigments of things. They are very fragile. Fortunately, we have a wonderful a climate-controlled painting storage area, so it will have a very good home. One of the things that we will do as soon as we get it is to have a paper conservator come and look at it. It's in very good shape. It had some work done in it at some point. So it's really amazing. It's in its original frame, but we'll certainly have her have a person, a conservator, come in and do an assessment for us as well.
Well, Kathy, thank you so much. I would love to talk more about the Historical Society, but we do need to push forward. So that's Kathy Sheehan from the Rensselaer County Historical Society telling us about the Historical Society's campaign to purchase a 1840s portrait of Peter Baltimore, whose barbershop was an important stop on the Underground Railroad. If you want to help Rensselaer County Historical Society purchase this rare portrait, you can donate online at rchsonline.org. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM. Why is it important to reflect on your experiences in life? A group of students from Rutgers University have been addressing this question in a multidisciplinary scrapbook project being led by a documentary artist and journalist named Jana McCone. McCone traveled with these New Jersey college students to the Sanctuary for Independent Media to meet up and study zine making with digital folk artist Brenda Ann Keneally, Guggenheim Fellow and creator of the Troy People's History Museum. WOOC correspondent Megan Marone sat down with their Rutgers program coordinator, Adam Stotts, students Mariah Pierce and Anthony Tullio, and Jana to hear why it is so important for students from challenging circumstances to courageously and creatively tell the stories of their lives.
My name is Adam Stotts. I'm the senior project coordinator for the Price Family Fellows Program. It's at the School of Social Work at Rutgers University. We are a program, we're funded by the Price Foundation. We've been at the university for, this is our fifth year operating, and our program is provide support to undergraduate students at the university that have a background in foster care or who are otherwise at risk for homelessness. So we're really an all-around support program for those students. Our goal is really to build a community for those students at the university. Most of them view the university as their home. So we build connections with them, with faculty, other staff members. Rutgers is a very big university, 50,000 students throughout the state. So it's easy for students to kind of get lost in the mix. And especially so our students who don't necessarily have the family support of others. So we really view the Price Family Fellows Program as a community for those students. So really making Rutgers a home for them, making sure that they're getting all the academic support that they need, that they make social connections and are able to take advantage of all the different programs and opportunities that are at the university. So a part of that is linking up our students with internships, making sure they're getting research experience in the fields that they're studying, finding the academic support that they need, trying to link them up with student groups and other recreational things. We also provide a summer internship program for those students, cover the cost of classes for them, things like textbooks, other supplies that they need. So really whatever they need to get through school, that's what we're there for.
Hey, my name is Jana McCone. I'm an artist, a documentarian, a journalist, and this year I'm doing a fellowship called the Hein Fellowship through the Center for Documentary Studies, and I'm collaborating to make stuff with these two lovely college students on either side of me, and I'll let them introduce themselves.
My name's Anthony. I'm a sophomore currently at Rutgers. I'm studying geography and IT, and I've been working with Jonah over the past year on the documentary project.
I'm Mariah. I'm a senior, public health major, Africana studies minor. I've been working with John on this project, and it's been really fun to learn about photography in the past year.
The Center for Documentary Studies is based in Durham, North Carolina, and it's been around, I think, since the 70s, and it's this awesome hub for all things steeped in kind of folklore, Southern studies, film photography, digital photography, audio storytelling, just kind of amazing people from around the country work there and teach classes. If you guys ever want to go down there, they have, like, continuing studies courses. You really just... It's hard to describe, but like there's a big porch and rocking chairs and huge banners with photographs. And you just kind of, for me at least as a documentarian, like you go down there and you just kind of feel like you're home.
So Mariah and Anthony, why are you at the Sanctuary for Independent Media in North Central Troy?
Yeah, it was about a year ago when Adam, my program coordinator for Price Family Fellows, approached us about the documentary project. I remember I first wanted to join because I'd always been really interested in art and seemed like another great avenue to like explore that. So the entire thing has been really awesome. We're here now because we're working on zines and more storytelling techniques. It's been really great. We've interacted with like a lot of artists and seen how they work and what their process is. And it's been really insightful to see, you know, the different ways people can make art viable in their life.
And Mariah, how about for you?
I mean, Anthony kind of summed it up pretty well. I would just like to add some of the things that's been amazing to see is why people pursue art, what's the passion behind it, and just how dedicated they are to what they do. I know for me, prior to this project, I didn't really think there was an art bone in my body. Like, so this has kind of really brought that creative side out of me that I like love that I necessarily don't get to always express being a college student and having to do academics, work, and, you know, other things.
So what are some of the goals of this project, would you say? I mean, what are you hoping to get out of scrapbooking your life? And could somebody just define finally for me what a zine is?
I would say my goal when we sort of found some funding to do a spring break trip was, I think really the goal was really simple initially, just to kind of all get out of like this public safety building that we meet in and just kind of like move across space and time together. Like get to, like I've gotten to hear what kind of music Anthony likes, and I know what Mariah is like as a roommate now, and Mariah has seen me in a beyond delirious state of exhaustion. But so that was really just simple, like be together and bond, because I do feel like they've put a really incredible amount of time and energy and thought into kind of these life stories that they've been working on with photographs and writing, delving into their family archives, telling oral histories, thinking about the relationship between memory and how we speak about ourselves and sort of the way that we think about ourselves and our possibilities. I think this scrapbook process was, I think, just a way I wanted them to collaborate with another artist. You know, Brenda's been doing photography for like more than twice as long. I think she's like twice as old as me. So I wanted them to get to work with someone else to make stuff and see what kind of came out of this in terms of actual pages for a book. Like right now we've got an exhibition that's going up that's sort of framed photographs. And then in terms of the zine definition, we did a zine workshop. Does anyone remember like or want to talk about defining zines? And we also went to the Tang Museum and saw a couple of zines. So I feel like you guys kind of know what they are.
To me, I mean, it's kind of from, you know, the word magazine. It's always been like a, to me, a zine is really like a collage that kind of has a certain aesthetic to it, you know.
Is it concept-based? Because if it's based on the word magazine, then you get a magazine based on like the Smithsonian, where you have History or National Geographic or Allure or Cosmopolitan. I don't know why certain magazines are coming to my head right now. But is there a concept behind the zine, would you say?
I guess for me, it's definitely like the storytelling narrative. Just trying to find a creative way to express both like my memories, like through these photographs that I've been finding and digging up, and also like how I feel now and reflecting on how all these things kind of interact and affect me today.
I guess zine also seems to imply something that is self-published, and it's almost an off-the-grid publication. I've had those connotations. I mean, I know Blue Stockings, the radical feminist bookstore in New York, they have workshops on zines. So it's interesting that you guys are making something that's kind of a living off the grid format for biography. Do you want to jump in on that, Mariah?
Definitely. I just want to kind of say, when I think of zines, I think of the ideas of like memories, even looking at the in the Chang Museum that we looked at, those zines were kind of like either an amazing like quote that they liked, or even like a comic book, something that means something to somebody. And I think that's where the underlying root lies within a zine, that it's something that you have this wonderful memory with and you kind of want to share it. And like, here's my zine.
I think you really just clarified it for me, which is that the off the grid component is, I'm trying to communicate this memory to you, and I'm going to use any way, any artistic format or visual format to communicate that memory. And collage almost seems to imply, or pastiche, that you're going to use a multiplicity of formats to communicate, this is what happened to me. So how is that going? And what do you see as the usefulness of telling the story of your lives in this way?
For me, it's definitely been really therapeutic, especially like the process of getting the photos. So I've had to interact a lot, you know, with my parents and my aunt and uncle, and definitely like, you know, they're curious what I'm working on, trying to frame that to them and explain to them, you know, what I'm documenting and why I'm documenting. It's been opening up avenues of conversation that definitely seem like my parents mostly would have wanted to ignore. So it's definitely been, therapeutic in that sense.
And have you run up against any uncomfortable moments? Because I imagine that, you know, you run up against some of your own narratives of what's happened in the past and then have to revisit those. And maybe it's almost like looking at all the splintered light coming through, that like there are so many different ways of looking at one memory. So have you had some challenging moments?
Yes. I mean, in writing my own narrative, it does bring back, even just writing about a particular moment, it brings up some emotions. It brings up a different part in time. And I think one thing I can appreciate from this is like just this oral storytelling part, that like one day I may not fully remember this. So having a written account and being able to, hey, share this with my children, like, this is my story. Almost like in the notebook when she does it, like, remember me this way, like, I'll always come back to you. Kind of in a sense, so I'm learning to appreciate that oral storytelling piece and being able to have this go down generations and maybe inspiring my kids to continue the story after I'm gone, or like other family members. But it has brought up those moments of trauma, that pain. And it's like, it's kind of like reopening a wound. But like Anthony said, it's in a sense therapeutic. Because you can talk about it, you can address it, and which is really good.
One of our, like, I guess I would say our first couple of meetings, it was a lot of people, like, talking about their experiences growing up and with foster care. And I really, like, just felt like it was so beautiful to hear everyone speaking and listening to each other and what that kind of shared experience was like. And then to start to try to think, like, for me as an artist, okay, what are the visual materials or the oral materials or the kind of material culture that we can sort of create out of these memories? And is that worthwhile or even valuable to people? And just kind of, like, think through that process. And the other thing I wanted to say was we have a lot of material, and I feel like we could just have a gallery show and be done with it. But I've been really, like, trying to make a photo book happen in some form, because I just want it to be like this really like thought out object that they'll have, that other people can pick up, that kids who face similar things growing up can pick up. And I think it kind of gets at what both of them were talking about, with like, you have a memory, but then, you know, it fades or it's lost. I think that this form will be really powerful once it's done. And there's really a reason to try to kind of stabilize it and contain it all and bind it in one kind of container.
Is there going to be a final showing of this work?
Right now we have a exhibit that will open at the Zimmerli Art Museum at Rutgers in early April. And then I'll probably plan some other show in the fall at a gallery. I don't know. I have to figure out where. There's some galleries in New York that I was thinking would be cool. But then it's we just are in a gallery in Manhattan just because. Or should we, I'm less familiar with the galleries in Brooklyn. But I really want to find the right space, because this show that's coming up is not quite the right space. But it's a good the work in progress show, I guess. So yeah, we'll have something.
So you're working with other artists, but Anthony, I know you're a visual artist, and do you have plans for Anthony and Mariah? Do you have plans for your own creative endeavors in the future, following in the footsteps of people who you're working with?
Definitely, yes. This project has sparked a high interest in photography. So I kind of would like to become a photographer, have that become my hobby a little bit more. We'll see how that works out. I'm hoping it does.
If anyone listening wants to donate us anything for cameras or stuff like that, I mean, it would be, yes, we need cameras.
How would we do that?
You can write to me. I'm Jonna McCone, and my email is jonnamckone@gmail.com.
Sorry. Cool. And Anthony?
Definitely. It's been really great to see, interacting with all the other artists. Growing up, I've always kind of been aware of the fact that, art isn't the best idea for career-wise. And so knowing that, it's always kind of, I think I've been downplaying my own interest in art because of that. But coming up here and working with all these other artists and seeing how they're actually able to make viable careers out of their passions, it's definitely been really eye-opening. As going through college and, my experience, I definitely think I've been growing an interest in, social work, or not necessarily social work, but advocacy in that kind of way. And it's been inspiring to see, hopefully in the future I'll be able to use, my own passion for art and my own passion for helping others and combine it in a meaningful way.
Well, thank you so much for being here, and we're looking forward to seeing your work.
That was digital folk artist Jonna McCone, Rutgers students Mariah Pierce and Anthony Tullio, and Rutgers Price Family Fellows Program Coordinator Adam Statz, speaking about their workshop with Guggenheim Award-winning artist Brenda and Keneally at the Sanctuary for Independent Media.
For those just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy. Last summer, my co-host Elizabeth Press and Angela Beeler set out on a project to examine the history of activism through storytelling while documenting the work of some key figures in social justice movements in the area. In this segment, they met up with Denise Figueroa from the Independent Living Center in Troy. They discussed the history of the Independent Living Center, Figueroa's personal history as a disabilities rights activist, and some current initiatives to make Troy more accessible. Denise Figueroa starts out by sharing her thoughts on terminology related to disability rights movement.
We don't use wheelchair bound. We don't use things like bound or victim or sick, things like that. But I use a wheelchair, or I'm a wheelchair user. A lot of us try to use people first language. I will say that some of us old timers in the disability rights movement feel like that there's nothing wrong with being disabled. And so saying you're disabled is a pride issue, and so that's okay. Hi, I'm Denise Figueroa, and I'm the executive director of the Independent Living Center of the Hudson Valley. I've been the executive director since we started 30 years ago here in Troy.
What is the Independent Living Center?
The Independent Living Center is an organization that is run by and for people with disabilities. The majority of our board of directors are people with disabilities, as well as the majority of our staff. And we are part of the disability rights movement. Our goal is to promote self-advocacy, self-empowerment, consumer control for people with disabilities. And we provide a variety of services that help people to live independently in the community. And in order to make that happen, in addition to services, we also do a lot of systems advocacy. So we look to change the world around us. Our goal is really to change the world and make it more accessible. For years, people with disabilities have been told they need to fit in. Our attitude about it is that, no, it's not that we need to fit in, it's that the community needs to change in order to for everybody to participate. It means sidewalks that you can negotiate. It means buildings that you can get into. But it's more than that. It's not just the physical access. It's also for people who are blind to be able to utilize services where there may be, like in restaurants, Braille menus. What's unique about an independent living center is that we're also not siloed like a lot of other services where it's only for one disability. We serve people with all types of disabilities, including mental health disabilities, physical, sensory, people with HIV, really any disability.
Can you talk a bit about when 30 years ago, what was happening? What did the center come out of?
The independent living movement really started back in the 1970s out in Berkeley, California. And so this was a kind of a reaction to that whole medical model of treating you as if there's something wrong with you, as if you're an illness that needs to be fixed. And so the independent living centers have grown across the country since the early 1970s. And we were formed in 1987. We were part of an expansion of independent living centers in New York State. There were 18 centers that were added that year. We already had an independent living center in Albany, but the folks in Troy felt like they really needed something that was here. In fact, I was at the independent living center in Albany when we wrote the grant and then received the funding to start it. And we started as a subsidiary of the Albany Center, but we were spun off the following year. So we've operated independently since then. And it was, like I said, to change the community, to try to make it more accessible. And at the time, it was before the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed. And so even though New York State had some strong building codes, there wasn't really a civil rights legislation for people with disabilities. And that's what the Americans with Disabilities Act is. And so the community was not as open. It wasn't as aware about disabilities. You know, lots of times people are hidden in their houses if the place is inaccessible. And if they can't get into buildings, people don't even realize they're there. So it has changed dramatically over the years. You see people out on the street, you know that there are people with disabilities in the community, and there's just been a huge impact with the ADA. And it's now been 27 years since the ADA was passed.
Do you consider yourself an activist?
Absolutely. My introduction to the disability rights community was when I was in my first year in college. I acquired my disability at 9 months old, so I was a person with a disability most of my life. But I was very sheltered and segregated through a lot of my grade school and part of high school, separated by disability groups and classes and things like that. So when I got to college, I met other people with disabilities, and it was an integrated environment. I went to Brooklyn College. I met other people with disabilities in the Disabled Students Organization. They are called So Fed Up, and it stood for the Student Organization for Every Disability United for Progress. At any rate, it was my first introduction to people actually advocating for their own rights, you know, on campus, trying to make the campus more accessible, meeting with the dean of students, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we did a lot of advocacy work, and that was back in 1972. So I also then started finding out about other folks out in the community. There was an organization called Disabled in Action. They were advocating for the passage of the Rehabilitation Act amendment, Section 504 of the Rehab Act, which was going to be the first time that there was any civil rights type language. And it basically said that if you received federal funding, you couldn't discriminate against people on the basis of disability. President Nixon had vetoed the Rehab Act because of that amendment. So we had a demonstration in New York City, and we marched from Federal Plaza up to Nixon's headquarters. He was running for re-election. And that was my introduction to the disability rights movement. I have been very involved in taking over streets in New York City for many, many years. So yes, I do consider myself an activist. You've got to be out there on the streets, unfortunately, sometimes, you know, to make it happen.
So we talked a little bit about what happened like 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. What sustained you in it, or activism? Like what could you attribute it to in your sort of background or personality that like...
Growing up with a disability and being treated differently, you know, than my sisters were. I couldn't necessarily always go to the same schools they went to. I would be lumped together with other people with disabilities, and... As a child, I resisted that and felt offended by it, you know, and couldn't understand what that was all about. And it wasn't until I got to college and met other adults with disabilities who were active and involved, and I started realizing that it wasn't bad working with other people with disabilities. That wasn't the problem. It was how people were treating me that was really the issue, that and I could put a name to it, you know, in terms of being discriminated against. That's what got me started, was meeting other people with disabilities who are active in the community. What keeps me going is knowing that there's so much to do and continuing my relationships with many of those people. When you're at the National Council on Independent Living Conference, the NICL Conference, and you're around 1,000 other people from all over the country and all over the world, it's very exciting and it's energizing. There's a lot of work to be done, but... You know, knowing that I was part of advocating for the 30 years ago for the Rehab Act, and then we got the Fair Housing Act and we got the ADA. And since then, you know, we have advocated for personal assistance services here in the state. And I'm on the board of the Capital District Transportation Authority. And one of my things in New York City was about getting accessible buses, you know, and I was part of the lawsuit suing the MTA, and written in the history of the ADA is the settlement of that lawsuit. And my name is in there as part of the settlement. So, you know, knowing that we've advocated and successfully advocated for accessible public transit is a big thing. You always have to remind yourself about the wins, because there's so many things you still have to do.
On your website, we were reading your mission statement, mm-hmm. and the words self-reliance and self-determination stuck out, referencing these, like the history among liberation movements. Mm-hmm. Is that on purpose? And what is the sort of priority in communicating these specific terms?
Well, it's absolutely on purpose, that's for sure. You know, the independent living movement was modeled after the civil rights movement, after the women's rights movement, after the consumer movement. And so when we talk about people, we talk about consumers here. We're not clients, we're not patients, we're consumers, because we are making decisions about what services we want to receive or what our needs are. And so self-empowerment it's a critical piece of what an independent living center does, what we promote. We run support groups. We work with young people to try to help them understand that, you know, that they have a right to make decisions about their lives. Particularly when you grow up with your disability, many people are sheltered. You have school systems that it's good. They're providing services. You don't really have an awful lot of control over what kind of services you get. And it's a very passive relationship. And so people need to learn how to take control, take responsibility for their lives, and know that people aren't going to take care of them for the rest of their lives, that they actually do have to make decisions.
Can you describe that, what the protest you were just said, a bit more? Like, what was the goal? What were you responding to? And can you kind of paint the scene for radio listeners?
Well, I think everybody knows that in this current administration, there has been an attack on healthcare and a threat to remove healthcare. And so, so people with disabilities have actually helped to put a face on what the impact of of those cuts would be and the loss of health care. There is so much prejudice and racism in this country that when you talk about Medicaid, people think about the welfare mom, in quotes, you know, who is just taking advantage of the system. And the truth of the matter is that the majority of people on Medicaid are people who are either working, not making enough money to be able to get health insurance, or they're people with disabilities and seniors who rely on that in order to live in the community. There's been a large group of activists, ADAPT is the name of the group that has been out there taking over Mitch McConnell's office, being dragged out in their wheelchairs, and trying to put a face on what this issue is really all about. And Nickel has a march every year. We always have a march and we go visit our congressmen. But this year, it was so much more important. We had probably 1,000 people there in Washington. There were people with every type of disability that you can imagine, wheelchairs, walkers, you know, canes, people who were blind and people who were deaf, and people with intellectual disabilities and autism, and you name it, we were there. We had a rally at the Capitol, as we always do, but then we went and visited our congressmen, and there were a group of folks that were arrested in the Senate Hart building. But we had about 40 people with disabilities arrested there protesting because it turned out it was the day of the vote. Unfortunately, they did decide to move on to take action. There was no legislation they were voting on. It was a procedural motion that they were making that day. Unfortunately, the world does not always view Medicaid in a favorable way and don't realize that it's your grandmother, it's your sister, your brother, whoever who could end up needing Medicaid. And disability doesn't make a distinction between being black or white or poor or rich or whatever. If you have a disability, chances are at some point you could end up having to rely on Medicaid.
Angela noticed this slogan on the wall, "Nothing about us without us.
Exactly. Yeah. And that is absolutely a motto that we have, you know, that nobody should be making policy about people with disabilities that doesn't include us in the planning process. In terms of wins specifically here in Troy, we're very proud of having been involved in developing the Complete Streets plan and the Complete Streets ordinance. We'd like to see it implemented, but it certainly is a start in saying that the city of Troy has adopted a policy that their streets should be accessible to everyone. And so working with the city on that is something that I think will have a big impact as we move forward. And it has already begun. You know, I think that the city has tried to identify areas where curb cuts need to be put in. I think also just our presence here in Troy has made a big difference with the business community. We started out across the street from where we are located right now. We're on 3rd Street in Troy. We were in the atrium and nobody knew we were there for 23 years. For the last 7 years, when we bought this building, I think people are more aware of the fact that we exist. And we've developed a good working relationship with all the businesses around here. So I think it's been very positive.
That was Denise Figueroa. She was interviewed by Angela Beeler and Elizabeth Press as part of a project that they are working on around the history of community organizing and activism in the area.
And now, on to our final segment. This is our weekly farm segment. Correspondent Mark Russo met up with neighboring Berkshire County farmers Michael Gallagher and Ashley Amston of Square Root Farms, where they've operated since 2010.
Hey, this is Mark Russo, WOOC's farm correspondent, and I am joined with Michael Gallagher and Ashley Amston from Square Roots Farm in Landsborough, Massachusetts. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for joining me. So, aside from Landsborough, Massachusetts, my first question for you is, where is your farm on the landscape? How big is it? And what's your farm like?
So we have 185 acres. It starts at the top of the ridge, runs down to Old Cheshire Road, crosses the road, and runs all the way down to the Cheshire Reservoir. So it's a hillside farm. It's about two-thirds in woods, and a lot of those woods are steep to very, very steep. and some of them are fairly wet. So we've got about 60 open acres, most of which is pasture. We've grown about 2 acres of vegetables. We're dropping that this year to about 1 acre of vegetables.
In addition to, or more specifically with those vegetables, what do you grow? And or do you grow any animals or people or any other things on your land?
Yeah, so in the past we have produced vegetables for a CSA. This year we're going to grow a more targeted number of vegetables for farmers markets. We also produce pasture-raised chicken, pork, turkey, eggs from pasture tents, and 100% grass-fed beef.
That sounds delicious. When did you start farming and why did you do it?
We started farming in 2010.
Yes.
Yeah. And we started farming on leased land up in Clarksburg. I don't know, why did we start farming?
We both came from teaching backgrounds and we found that work really rewarding, but it wasn't quite hitting the spot.
For me, it was really burnout. I spent 2 years teaching down in Mississippi and feeling like that was really important work and it was really good work and it was really hard work and it wasn't sustainable for me. It wasn't healthy for me and wasn't sustainable for me, and it was it wasn't working. So I was looking for something that felt more balanced, that felt really directly useful, and where I felt like I could have a real concrete view of the progress that I was making. So that I could like have really tangible results.
And farming helps us work on our, you know, values of sustainability and community connection and producing products that contribute to human health. So it kind of hits all those key points for us.
Indeed, that's part of my personal interest in farming is similar. It's such a broad thing that it challenges you in so many ways as an individual and also is so satisfying on so many different really basic levels. So why do you keep it up? It's not easy work. So what keeps you doing it every season?
Part of it is the impact that we can see on our land and on our community. So one of my favorite things to do in the middle of the summer is to walk up to where our meat chickens have run and to look at the path that they've created in the pasture. Where the chicken pens have run, the grass is lush and dark green and gorgeous, and you can sort of see that as stripes standing out against the landscape. So even in just a matter of a few weeks, we can have this really rewarding experience of knowing that the animal impact is improving the land. And, you know, over time, I can't wait to see what happens.
That's so tremendous, too, given the kind of in the media, such a animal agriculture tends to get such a bad rep. We hear about manure lagoons in Iowa and all kinds of terrible things that happen. But as you said, when animals are managed properly, holistically, they can be a real benefit to the landscape.
Absolutely. We're seeing some of our pastures turn around with the impact that our animals have had.
I mean, one of our sort of smaller pastures that's kind of closer to the house, before we bought the farm, one of our neighbors used to hay it, and he would only take a first cut off because there wasn't a second cut to be had. He'd take the first cut, nothing would grow back, so that was it. And that's a pasture that we grazed 5 times last year. And we're seeing a lot of response in our grass and in our pastures to our grazing management, both like the grazing of the beef and the rest, and also the fertility impact from the poultry.
The other thing that keeps us going, I think, is the impact we see in our community. So thanks to a lot of programs that are going on in the area, we're able to reach people across all kinds of income levels. And particularly people who are receiving SNAP benefits, we're able to serve a lot of those folks, and that feels really good that we're bringing these healthy products raised in a sustainable way to all kinds of people regardless of their income.
So I've interviewed a number of farmers who participate in the CSA model, community supported agriculture, where people pay upfront and then receive a share of vegetables throughout the rest of the year. Seems to be very popular. What are your reasons for stepping away from that model and going towards a farmer's market that may be more volatile?
So there are a lot of things we love about growing for CSA. The connections that we've made with our customers over the years are fantastic. It's really rewarding to bring people out to the farm to get their food. And in a lot of ways, we're really going to miss that model.
Absolutely.
We also have really struggled with growing for that model because you have to raise a really wide range of vegetables, but not in a great quantity. So you have to kind of be good at doing a lot of different things on a small scale. It takes a lot of attention and a lot of planning and a lot of labor. And we're growing our family this year. We're expecting a baby in July.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. And so labor is definitely on our minds, and what we're going to have for our labor force is on our minds. We also really want to be able to take a step back and make sure that we're really doing a good job with all of the things we're doing. So we don't know if this is a long-term, you know, solution or if we're just taking a break from CSA at this point, but it should give us a chance to step back and examine our practices and really make sure that we're doing things in a way that's sustainable for us, for our family, for the land, financially, going forward.
Yeah, and to add to that, I think the other big reason that we are stepping away from the CSA has been our labor struggles in terms of finding the appropriate labor at the appropriate time. And we've had some really fantastic people work for us who we're just so glad to have in our lives. But it became like such an uncertainty that, and we had way too much riding on something that was far too uncertain, that if we didn't find the right person, and at our scale it really is one person, it's not like we're hiring a crew of three or four people and we need most of them to be pretty good. We're hiring a crew of one person who really has to really hit the nail on the head for everything to work. And if that doesn't work, if the person doesn't work out or we don't find the person, the consequence of that was that like our whole year was incredibly stressful and really hard. So by removing the CSA, we reduced a lot of the pressure on that point of our business.
Lightning round. Lightning round question number one, Rose and Thorn, what's your favorite part of farming and what's something about it that you don't really like?
Favorite part, getting food to customers and having them enjoy it. Thing that I don't really like.
Labor? Dealing with labor?
Yeah, absolutely. Managing labor.
I think my rose would be just being able to watch things change and grow over time in the landscape and in the community. And my thorn would be dealing with all the different levels of uncertainty.
Okay, last question. What is your favorite thing that you grow and what's your favorite way to prepare that?
So on the farm, we're really busy and it's hard to plan ahead and sometimes you just don't have the energy to be creative. So taking one of our whole pastured chickens and just throwing it in the oven to roast it is the perfect solution sometimes.
Classic.
It doesn't need anything special, just put it in the oven, it tastes delicious.
Onions, sautéed in butter.
An excellent accompaniment to chicken. Yeah. Well, Michael and Ashley, thank you so much for joining me. I look forward to visiting your farm at some point in the future. Any last words?
Thanks for talking with us.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. Thank you.
Hoorie. Take care.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Elizabeth Press.
And I'm Eric Newton. Remember to tune back in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments or suggestions, you can text us at 518-888-3004.